Blog Talk Radio.
International isolation after it rejected a UN resolution
defending the human right to food. After a week of UN debates on humanitarian affairs, U.S. diplomats were the only ones to vote against a resolution supporting the right to food. The related text was sponsored by an unusual majority of 131 countries, and another 44 UN member states yesterday voted in favor of this resolution. Diplomats at the debates agreed the U.S. delegation's stance ignored the right of every person to not suffer from hunger. The approved proposal reaffirms hunger is a disgrace and violates human dignity. And we didn't support that. And
no,
I think it's very sad.
Yeah. And, you know, it's another sad thing is that this country has changed. We're hurting too. A lot of people are hurting in this country, and we want to try to bring that forward. This show is going to specialize each night actually on a different subject. I think Lila has come up with that idea, and I think that's a great idea. But tonight we're going to be talking about world hunger and hunger right here in the United States. But before we go on to anything like that, I just want to mention, I want to thank everybody. If you tuned in yet, please do. And there's a phone number out there you can call us on, and I'm going to give it's right on the it's right on the front of the website that you're looking at, and please do that. And I see if I have that here, right at the front here. That number is 646-915-9505. Now you can call that number and be on air, and we can talk to several people at the same time. We can take up to 5 callers all at the same time,
so
we can have a real discussion here if you want to do that. And the number of people that can access this show is unlimited, and it's a marvel. So we're very pleased to be on Blog Talk Radio. And again, Lila, go ahead. It's another real good article there.
No more hungry Americans, U.S. government says. And this is from Breitbart.com. The U.S. government has tweaked its terminology in referring to the nearly 11 million Americans who face a constant struggle with hunger to refer to them as people with very low food security. Why can't we just say they're hungry? According to a report released this month by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, roughly 35 million Americans had difficulty feeding themselves in 2005. Of those, some 10.8 million went hungry. The change in terminology, apparently we called people who were hungry as people with few food insecurity. And now we call them, what do we call them?
Hungry.
We call them
food insecure, yeah.
We call them people with very low food security. It's kind of silly, all this rhetoric.
Yeah.
But anyway, the change in terminology has angered groups that fight hunger who say it is aimed at hiding a stark reality. There are 35 million people in this country who are struggling with hunger, and no matter what you call it, it's still just hunger. And there is no way to ultimately to obscure the fact that an incredibly wealthy country, and we have 35 million people who are hungry, and I think it's really sad.
Yeah,
I mean, no matter what words you give it, they still don't have enough food.
Yeah.
And I don't care whether they call it people with very low food security or they call it people with food insecurity.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter what they call it. People are still hungry. And I think it's ridiculous to be talking that way. Why don't they just say what it is?
Yeah, no, there's... what we're going to do tonight is we just try to focus on American hunger, and then we're going right into some world hunger areas that people aren't really aware of, and countries that don't get much press. So go ahead, Lila, please.
There's hunger rising in New York City, and this is right off of Yahoo News. Nearly 1 in 6 city residents lived in households that could not afford to buy enough food during the 3-year period ending in 2005. according to the New York City report against hunger. These households made up 15.4% of the city residents, up 14% from 2000 and 2003. According to the Coalition survey of the city's food pantries and soup kitchens, the number of people served by those charities rose an estimated 11% in 2006. About 1.1 million of the city's 8.1 million residents received food stamps. Advocates estimate that hundreds of thousands more are eligible. And to target some of those people, city employees will visit food pantries and soup kitchens during the holidays to help residents fill out food stamp applications. I think that's wonderful to help prevent hunger that they're going to do that.
Yeah.
So kudos to the people in New York City for trying to help people and go out and get them where they are.
Yeah. The reason we do this, too, is not that we always do it. We have almost every year. You know, we didn't really touch on it last night on the radio show. This time of year, it really, I guess it means a lot, and we got to do it. And I'm grateful that, in a way, we can use this to do that, do this too.
Well, I think one of the things, I think what you're trying to say is that at this time of the year, many people donate food to food pantries and soup kitchens.
Yeah.
And there's a great push in, you know, if you work in an office or you work in a company, and sometimes when you go to the grocery store, they, people are very generous and they donate at this time of the year to the hungry, and it's really wonderful, but it's never really enough because hunger doesn't go on just on Thanksgiving or Christmas. It goes on 365 days of the year, all the days of the year.
Yeah, whatever, but we're going to tell you more about American hunger, and I don't know. I don't want this to get way down, and hopefully it won't, but we can pick it up a little bit in a few minutes. But these are remarkable things that we're trying to bring out to you.
Now, in North Korea, moving to the international scene, it's not only people who are hungry in American cities, but people are hungry many places in the world. North Korea may be heading back to famine, and this is from the Reuters Foundation. Reports from fleeing North Koreans of food shortages and the suspension of international aid after the country's nuclear test suggest that the communist state may be slipping into famine, an aid worker said on Monday. The comments by the head of the charity Helping Hands Korea, these comments were by him, and his name is Tim Peters. It's an extreme possibility we may see a return to famine, Peters told reporters. I hope it won't happen, but the world needs to be aware it could take place. Late last month, the International Crisis Group think tank said the flow of refugees into neighboring China and elsewhere threatened to turn into a torrent due to the reclusive state's isolation and starvation. Analysts say North Korea cannot produce enough food for even itself in the best crop years, and that much of the food is diverted to the military. Summer storms are thought to have badly damaged crops and key grain. Food aid has largely stopped after North Korea ignored international warnings by testing missiles in July. Peters, a Seoul-based Christian pastor whose charity has wide contact with North Korean refugees, said increasingly sophisticated monitoring on the Chinese side of the border suggested Beijing was readying for a large-scale influx of North Koreans. Nearly all those who flee North Korea, the numbers range from tens to hundreds of thousands, do so to neighboring China. They either stay there or seek refuge elsewhere in Asia. Oh, also, people might like to know that anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan.
We had her on the air back when Katrina last year,
mm-hmm.
And she was actually in Louisiana handing out food as she was down there in a bus, and we were doing the interview with her, and actually we got cut off because it was a cell phone, but we got about 15 minutes, and she was passing it out. She was just totally freaked by what was happening down there, and the indifference of the government agencies were absolutely unbelievable. She had a busload of grain and busload of food that she was passing
she's
out.
A,
and stuff.
She's a wonderful
yeah,
woman.
Yeah, she was going wild on her. But anyway, you can read that.
But right now she is. Her son Casey was killed during combat in Iraq in April of 2004. In this article, it pictures her hugging Hwang Pil-soon, the mother of a village headman, Kim Jae-tae, during a news conference in Seoul in November 20th, 2006. Kim is in jail for protesting against the expansion of the U.S. military base in Phuong Tek. A delegation of U.S. peace and social justice activists led by Sheehan arrived in Seoul on Sunday for a six-day visit to object to the expansion of Camp Humphrey, the U.S. military base, and to protest against a plan for a free trade agreement between South Korea and the U.S. I think it's wonderful. She really rallies to the cause everywhere in the world. It's not just here. It's not just war. It might be hunger. It could be a woman who's suffering because her son is jailed. Anything where she sees injustice, she seems to be the first one to go there, and I admire her
yeah,
greatly.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know. There's a lot of criticism there. We've also had Jody Evans on the show.
Well,
she's the founder of Code Pink.
Code Pink. People can criticize all they like, but she's an activist who truly is an activist. She gets up and she goes. She doesn't complain at home. She actually does something, and I have to say I admire it. And I admire her energy and commitment, and I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. So what's next there? Before you go into Burundi, let me just give a short one just to break it up for a minute. This is knocking out. NSA looks at plan to block out the sun. This is taken in by.
Well, this is a departure from
just
from food. So you're talking
well,
about something.
It is, but in a way it relates because it's environmental and it's what's happening here. November 20th, 2006. The idea seems something out of a Superman comic. A machine or missile shoots tons of particles into the atmosphere that would block their sun's rays, cool down the overheated Earth, and reverse global warming. But at the weekend, scientists gathering in a closed session organized by NASA and Stanford University to discuss research. Researching such a strategy. The idea is called geoengineering, using technology to tinker with the Earth's delicate climate balance. Ken Caldera, a climate scientist at the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University, said his modeling showed the idea worked. He found that if you blocked 20% of the sunlight over the Arctic Ocean, it would be enough to restore sea ice, he said. Now, I don't know if anybody's familiar with the chemtrail process, but we're seeing a whole lot of it up in around New England, and there have been reports of it all over the country, where they're trying to block out at least 1% of the world's atmosphere. Yeah, the world, the light or cloud seeding the world atmosphere. And you know, this is we got a good friend of ours, John Brennan, and I hope he will join us on the show one of these days. I'm not sure. I wasn't able to reach him today, but you might call in. John, if you're listening, we could use your input. But John's a big researcher in chemtrailing and geomodification of the Earth's atmosphere, and which is causing a lot of global climate changes and whatnot, and also causing a lot, you'll see in the later articles, about climate changes causing global hunger. So, you know, great article, interesting thing.
Wonder if they do that, what other effects that will have. Yes, it'll probably stop the melting, as they think, of the ice in the Arctic or the Antarctic, wherever they do it. But what else could that do? You cut down on 20% of the light, and very often they do these things and they don't really fully understand the complete consequences of their plans.
Yeah, and what will happen is you block out 20% of the Arctic or the Antarctic with
the sunlight.
I mean, then what will happen to the environmental? What will happen to all the animals and the people living in the Arctic, the Eskimos and so on, and the people
and
in Alaska?
And the plant life.
And the plant life, sure. God, everything. I mean, it's so barren there as it is. It all depends on,
it's so beautiful. The way the Earth, planet Earth is designed is that it was beautifully balanced.
Hmm.
And when it gets out of balance, with that, is it really out of balance? That would be the question.
If you just get these countries to stop messing with so much carbon pollution and
starting with
gases,
us.
Yeah, it's important. And I hate to be hypocritical, and I am probably as much as most, but because I drive a car and. But there's not much you can do unless we pressure everybody pressure the world to stop driving cars or driving better fuel cars or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, what amazes me is they were complaining about that penguin show,
mm-hmm.
right? That new penguin show. You heard about it, right? Happy Feet, right? And they were complaining about it because they're saying that that it was a statement against climate control or climate change,
mm-hmm.
right? Or a statement for the awareness of climate change. But I don't know. I think anything you can do to make people aware of it is a good thing. So go ahead. Why don't you read another one of those articles that amazing. Anybody who wants to call, if anybody's listening out there and wants to give us a call, you can do that at the number you're looking at right now.
They know if they're looking at it, they know what the telephone number is because it's right on the front of their website there.
But if they're not, for some reason, because what happens, what happens is they may black out, look at something else, and what happens is a little speaker thing will come on the top, so they may not be looking at our thing, and for some reason they misplaced the number. But that's okay. We'll get back to that in a second. Go ahead, Lila. And I'll repeat that number in a few minutes.
Okay. When you can find it.
When I can find it.
This is from Boston.com. It's not about hunger, but it's about people getting their utilities shut off. It's an all-time high. This is actually in Rhode Island. This came out November 19th. Utility companies have turned off service for a record number of Rhode Islanders, the most since the state started keeping track in 1997. Not only are people hungry, but they're also cold. More than 25,000 people lost electricity or natural gas service by last month because they could not pay, according to the State Division of Public Utilities and Carriers. That represents a 12% increase over last year. Shutoffs among households that receive no federal heating assistance expanded by almost 15%, and it outpaced shutoffs among households that receive government assistance.
I wanted to go forward from there. That was recorded back in November 22nd, 2006, and there have been a remarkable number of updates, as you know, in the last 5 years. But perhaps the most remarkable one is that back in 2006, we reported that there were 35,000 people that were without food assistance, that had food assistance issues. But now there's 35%, there's 50 million people in this country that are collecting food stamps. And 50 million also that are without insurance. And of course, food prices, electric prices, and so on have skyrocketed. So, things have changed dramatically. But I'm hoping that you might understand, get some idea what's happened over the last 5 years. It's remarkable. I mean, we've seen it here, and you know, here in 2011. But it's great to be able to have this show archive that first program, because it puts things in perspective as to how bad things have gotten. All right, that back in 2006. It was 35 million people in this country were poor, and had food insecure insecurity problems, and one out of six people were actually hungry in this country, and we talked about other countries around the globe that were having severe problems as well, and that has increased you know, exponentially, right? In the last 5 years, and unfortunately, we don't hear about it that much. I have another article here that I wanted to read tonight. Actually, it's more than an article. I think it's actually a a short video by Bernie Sanders talking about many people above the poverty line are struggling to make ends meet, and I think that's critical. I'm hoping I can get that video up here. Actually, it's not really a video. I guess it's thought it was. It's not. It's actually a slight. It's a very short article. Came out today, actually, November 23rd, 2011. Nearly half of all Americans lack economic security, meaning they live above the federal poverty threshold, but still do not have enough money to cover housing, food, health care, and other basic expenses, according to a survey of government and industry data. The survey, released on Tuesday by the advocacy group Wider Opportunities for Women, found that 45% of U.S. residents live in households that struggle to make ends meet. 45% of U.S. residents. That's almost half of this country is struggling to get by. That breaks down to 39% of all adults and 55% of all children, the group found. And this is a wake-up call for Congress, for our state policymakers, really for all of us, said Donna Adickson, president and CEO of WOW, which is Women, Wider Opportunities for Women. She said that nearly half of our nation's families cannot cover the cost of basic expenses, even when they do have a job. And under these conditions, cuts to unemployment insurance and other programs families are relying on right now would push them from crisis to catastrophe. And the article goes on a little. I think I'll read it. It's from Reuters. Come up a little slow here. But I think that it's incredible that the that, you know, in this day and age when we're, you know, we're struggling, you know, with so much, and you know, so many people are just can't make it. The WOW survey compared 2009 pre-tax incomes to a budget of basics, of basic and essential monthly expenses for various families that it developed along with researchers at Washington University with funding from the Ford Foundation and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. For example, in a budget for a family of one worker, it put housing expenses at $688 and food at $244. In a family of two workers with two young children, it assumed housing would cost $821 per month and food would be $707 a month. It did not include non-essentials such as vacations, recreation, hobbies, college tuition, and other common expenses of the middle class. A congressional effort to find $1.2 trillion in spending cuts over 10 years failed on Monday
raising fears that emergency benefits for the long-term unemployed would not be extended when they expire next month. Other social programs, including Medicare, are also under threat as lawmakers seek to slash the nation's huge debt. Now, some economists said while they agreed with the debt had while they agreed that the debt had to be reduced, the targeting program that helped the low-income groups survive the harsh economic environment was not the correct path to take. I am in favor of austerity, but not in this area, said Ham Vanholtz, chief U.S. economist at Yini Credit Research in New York. This is the only austerity going on, and this is hitting the long-term unemployed. It's not improving the long-term budget situation any. And currently, the poverty threshold of the United States is an annual income of $22,314 for a family of four. I don't know anybody who can get by on that with a family of four. And a little more than 15% of the country lives at or below that level. And the group wanted to look at the remainder, many of whom live on the edge and are chronically at risk of financial crisis or falling into poverty. More than 4 out of 10 adult women live in households that cannot cover those basic expenses, slightly more than the proportion of men at 37%. That may be because in 2009, women's median earnings were 70% of men's median earnings, and more than 60% of single women live in economic insecurity. While married women are more likely to have economic insecurity than unmarried women, much of the stability is attained through a husband's earnings or other household income, the group reported, but can put those women in economic jeopardy if their husbands die or lose their jobs or if the couple divorces. The group also found that full-time work fails to provide economic security for 25% of adult workers because of stagnating and failing wages over the last decade. A chief cause of economic insecurity is 1970s level wages that fail to cover modern expenses, it said. While households with two full-time workers can help boost a family's income security, 22% of adults with children who work full-time and have a partner who also has a full-time job cannot cover basic means, or needs, rather. In the at the same time, 21% of homes headed by a college graduate lack economic security. In the past, threats to economic security were supposedly clear, dropping out of high school, being a single parent, or having a large family. In today's economy, we cannot assume we know who lacks security, it said. So this is what's going on today, and it's really quite frightening when you look at it from the standpoint of pretty rough. And this is from this article was a Reuters article, but it was posted on Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont's website. And I'm just looking here at there's another article. It's called Tough Times. I just want to see what this is. During a weekly radio interview on the Tom Hartman Show, Senator Bernie Sanders talks about how this Thanksgiving he'll be thinking of the millions and millions of Americans struggling through difficult economic times. We should be very aware that this is an extremely difficult moment in American history and that the people who are hurting right now are not alone, Sanders said. This is a system that's failing, and we need to stand together to make fundamental changes so that we fulfill the potential of this great country. He's right. He's right on that. You know, you have to be able to do that. I don't know what else to say. I've got a couple other articles that aren't related to this actually, but before I do that, I thought I'd just quickly play a tune that I posted recently. If I can find it, here it is. And it's by Buffy St. Marie. It's very short. It's only about a minute long, but it's called "Ain't No Time for the Worrying Blues." Let me just play that quickly, and I'll be right back. Hopefully that'll come up in just a second here. This was written in 1975 and recorded then by Buffy St. Marie. I'm hoping this thing comes up. I don't know what it's about. Delay. Here it is. Okay. For God's sakes. This is put out by Buffy St. Marie, but unfortunately, oh, something. Things always happen when you least expect them to. Folks, don't look like this is playing. Does not look like this wants to play. Well, I played earlier. Unfortunately, it's not playing now. Ah, wouldn't you damn know it. This was so good, too. Let me see if I can get it again. St. Marie, ain't no time to worry. Ain't no time for worrying blues. Let's see if it plays. Here we go. Seems to be having problems coming up here. Thank you. We've got another 20 minutes here of the show, and I wanted to, I've got a number of articles that I still want to read. Excuse me. There is a, several things that came up recently. And one is that rich nations give up on new climate treaty until 2020. This was posted today by The Guardian. .com. Excuse me a second. And hopefully, God, this I don't know if it's the internet or just my computer, but things are so slow coming up. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, not gonna do that. I hate it when they put blocks up on these things because they, you know, then they want you to apply and all this stuff. They did, that didn't happen before, but they want it now. Okay. Here's another. I was going to get into this later, but it's probably time to do that now. Medical marijuana. U.S. rules that marijuana has no accepted medical use. Now, that's so bizarre, okay? It's so damn bizarre, all right? And there's an article here by the LA Times. It claims that marijuana has been approved by California, many other states in the nation's capital to treat a range of illnesses. But in a decision announced Friday, the federal government ruled that it has no medical use, all right? Which is such crap, okay? Such bogus. Okay, and that it just drives you out of your mind, you know, to think that they would do this, you know, to deny all of the evidence, tremendous amount of evidence, you know, that talks about this. This is the Los Angeles Times. The decision by the DEA comes almost 9 years after medical marijuana supporters asked the government to reclassify cannabis to take into account a growing body of research that shows its effectiveness in treating certain diseases. Marijuana has been approved by California and many other states. Now, this was in July 9th that this was written by John Hoffel for the New York, for the Los Angeles Times. Says that marijuana has been approved by California and many other states in the nation to treat a range of illnesses. But in a decision announced Friday, the federal government ruled that it has no accepted medical use and should remain classified as a highly dangerous drug like heroin. It's ridiculous. And the decision comes almost 9 years after medical marijuana supporters asked the government to reclassify cannabis to take into account a growing body of worldwide research that shows its effectiveness in treating certain diseases such as glaucoma and multiple sclerosis. Advocates for the medical use of the drug criticized the ruling, but were elated that the Obama administration has finally acted, which allows them to appeal to the federal courts. The decision to deny the request was made by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. It comes less than 2 months after advocates asked the U.S. Court of Appeals force the administration to respond to their petition. We have foiled the government's strategy of delay, and we can now go ahead to head on the merits, said Joel, for the chief counsel for Americans for Safe Access and the lead attorney on the lawsuit. Excuse me. Sorry, I'm choked up here tonight, too. Alford said he was not surprised by the decision, which comes after the Obama administration announced it would not tolerate large-scale commercial marijuana cultivation. It is clearly motivated by a political decision that is anti-marijuana, he said. He notes that studies demonstrate pot as beneficial effects, including appetite stimulation for people undergoing chemotherapy. And one of the things people said about marijuana is that it gives you the munchies, and the truth is that it does. And for some people, that's a very positive thing. And in July 21st letter to the organizations that filed the petition, DEA Administrator Michelle Leonhardt said she rejected the request because marijuana has a high potential for abuse, has no currently acceptable medical use and treatment in the United States, and lacks accepted safety for use under medical supervision. The letter and 37 pages of supporting documents were published Friday in the Federal Register. This is the third time that petitions to reclassify marijuana have been spurned, and the first was filed in 1972 and denied 17 years later, and the second was filed in 1995, denied 6 years later. And both decisions were appealed, but the court sided with the federal government. And it goes on and on and on and on, but and a long article, but it's worth thinking about. Even though this was published in the law, became effective July 9th of this year, it still stands to reason that marijuana is a very good medicine. Now, this is a hemp is the superior plant. This is a YouTube video which claims the remarkable benefits of hemp or marijuana, if you will, or both hemp and marijuana. It's about 3 minutes long. Hopefully it will play for you. So much of this has snags in it. So many of these YouTubes.
Also known by its Latin name, cannabis, is...
You have to excuse... This is a good video. You have to excuse these snags here. So annoying.
After grains such as millet, one of the oldest cultivated plants in the world, it is assumed that the history of farming began...
I'm sorry, this is not playable. It was earlier, and again, I don't know if it's my own system or what, but I'm getting all these snags in here. I apologize. But anyway, it goes on to explain the superiority of the plant hemp itself, that it can be grown anywhere... under almost any terrain, and that it is grown everywhere around the world, and that it it not only is it so valuable as a nutrition wise, okay, hemp seeds and hemp oil is extremely nutritious, extremely and medicinal. Has many medicinal purposes to it, very effective. But it's also an effective painkiller. It's also an effective drug against anxiety and whatnot. And it also is a great cancer cure. And I played a couple shows back. I played a video regarding cancer cures by marijuana. And it's so incredible to me that a country can ignore a natural, incredible, overwhelmingly magical and mystical plant, all right, that can be grown and as a renewable energy, can its resins can be made into take the place of plastics. Its oils can be used as a not only in medicine, but they are a remarkably efficient biofuel. So all of these things are available to everyone at a cost of no cost of just planting this stuff in fields that are barren, that can't grow anything, and hemp will grow there, okay? It's like everything else in this country. It just makes no damn sense. Makes no sense at all. Why it's not allowed and why it's not legal. Getting off that subject as to illegal, let's go to another criminal country here. Israel. Israel says no to nuclear transparency. I mean, it's totally bizarre that they could actually deny the Nuclear Energy Agencies to inspect their facilities, saying, you know, just to outright deny it when the world knows that they have them, right? It's just the ultimate hypocrisy is Zionism. Israel has once again refused to acknowledge international calls for transparency in its covert nuclear program during a meeting held by the International Atomic Energy Agency. During the Nuclear-Free Middle East Conference in Vienna, Deputy Head of Israel's Atomic Energy Commission, David Danieli, said on Monday that Tel Aviv would not begin talks on the issue. Experience shows that such a process can only be launched when normal peaceful relations exist in the region and when the threat perception of all regional members is low, he has, quote, he was quoted as saying by the Associated Press. Political instability opens hostility, deep mistrust and noncompliance with international obligations are too common in many parts of the Middle East region, he argued. Well, then so much for that. I mean, why not be open about it? This is why participants in the gathering condemned Tel Aviv's response, saying Israel's massive nuclear arsenal and local lack of transparency will make the goal of a nuclear-free Middle East completely impossible. And Syria said Israel is posing a grave and serious threat through its undeclared atomic arsenal. And last year, the 189 members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty decided to convene a UN-sponsored conference on establishing a Middle East nuclear-free zone in 2012. This year's meeting was an incentive for most of the nations to meet with Israel for the exploratory Vienna talks. And despite international condemnation, Tel Aviv still remains unclear whether it will even attend the 2012 talks. Israel is considered to be the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. It refuses to allow inspections of its nuclear facilities or to join the NPT based on its policy of nuclear ambiguity. And according to a recent survey conducted by the Berlin-based Friedrich Ebert Foundation, more than 50% of European people believe Israel is the most serious threat to global security. Now, there you go, pal. I mean, you know, this country is a nightmare. And it's backed by these two criminals, okay? As it turned out, you know, Bush, Blair, and Blair were found guilty of war crimes in a Malaysia tribunal. That's right, folks. That just came up today. And I'm going to go to that right now and see what the story is here. And I want you to be interesting. It's from Press TV as well. A Malaysian tribunal has found former U.S. President George W. Bush and former Prime Minister Tony Blair guilty of committing crimes against humanity during the Iraq War. The Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal found the former heads of state guilty after a four-day hearing. A seven-member panel chaired by former Malaysian federal... hang on 1 second, folks. Trying to get this to pause.
Former U.S. President George...
Right.
Bush and his former counterpart... Tony Blair...
This is only 2 minutes long.
...were found guilty of war crimes by the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, which held a four-day hearing in Malaysia. The five-panel tribunal unanimously decided that Bush and Blair committed genocide and crimes against.
I just can't stop this thing. I want to read this because the video is so chopped up that it's not very good. A five-panel tribunal unanimously decided that the former U.S. and British leaders had committed crimes against the peace and humanity, and also violated international law when they ordered the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. A prosecutor at the hearing ruled that the invasion of Iraq was a flagrant abuse of law, an act of aggression that amounted to a mass murder of the Iraqi people. Bush and Blair are found guilty under the same laws that applied to the Nazis after the end of the World War II. So they are international criminals, war criminals, guilty of Nuremberg crimes against peace, and they should be prosecuted by any state in the world that gets a hold of them. We will continue our efforts to bring Bush and Blair to justice and put them in a jail, Francis Boyle, an international law expert and prosecutor, told Press TV. The judges in the verdict said that the United States, under the leadership of Bush, forged documents to claim the Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And Bush and Blair were tried in absentia by the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal at the end of the hearing. The participants also demanded that the findings of the tribunal be made available to members of the Rome Statute and that the names of the two former officials be entered in the Register of War Criminals. There is also a recommendation that this be circulated to the states because all states have universal jurisdiction. Therefore, whenever Bush or Blair appear within their shores, there is an obligation on the international law to commit these international war criminals through the justice system, a prosecutor told Press TV. Lawyers and human rights activists in Malaysia have described the verdict issued to Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal against Bush and Blair as a landmark decision. They said they say that they would lobby the International Criminal Court to charge the pair for war crimes. The Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal is scheduled to hold a separate hearing next year on charges of torture linked to the Iraq War against former U.S. officials, including ex-Vice President Dick Cheney, former Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, and ex-Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. So, folks, it's not over yet. There's karma in the wind, and it took the state of Malaysia to bring it forward. And we're at the end of time, and I want to thank everybody. Listen, I'm sorry I couldn't get some of those videos up tonight, but anyway, we're just about out of time. I wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, and we hopefully will be back on Friday night with George Dixon. That'll be up to George and see how time goes, but I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving, and wish you the very best, and good night.